We're nearing the end of a study concerning the existence of God, the reality of God's existence, and what the evidence are that have led many to believe that He does exist. Most of our evidences, clues, things that point in the direction of there being a God up until last week often fell in the area of what some would consider philosophy. That's a branch of study in which human knowledge is examined and how we come to knowledge and what's the basis upon which we base our knowledge and all of those things. And we know for a fact that until just a couple of hundred years ago, there really was no significant movement in our whole world that could be labeled as atheism. Yeah, there were individual people and maybe very small groups of people all through history who claimed to be non-believers in any superior being. But there was no organized movement, but it's only been in the last 200 years that such a concept has gained enough traction, shall we say, enough support, that it's now a widespread movement, at least in the Western world, as it's called, and which someone just a few weeks ago claimed in one of the big magazines, I forget whether it was Time or Newsweek, that the fastest growing belief system in America right now is non-belief in God, especially in the under 30 age group. Several things have probably contributed to that non-belief. And when we say non-belief, we don't mean just a benign ignorance of God's existence, but an active, vocal, outspoken opposition to the idea that God exists. Among those things is the great promises that some in the scientific field over the last 100 years or so have made that science will finally answer all of our questions and science will finally solve all of our problems, and we no longer need God either to provide the reason why we believe some things or to be the answer for some of the things we believe, because science will give us those answers. Science will give us the reasons. Science has failed. When you get right down to it, science, not the pure thing itself called science, but some of those in the scientific field still shout loud and long about having the answers. And among them, we find some of the most outspoken atheists as well. And yet, what are their answers? They're still unsatisfactory. The belief that God Himself is the one who has made everything, is not only the creator, but the designer, the organizer, the maintainer of everything, is still a far more intellectually satisfying answer than the answers that science have come up with. And the belief that God Himself created life, all life, including humanity itself, is still a more reasonable answer than anything science has come up with, in spite of what they claim. And the best that science has come up with, when you come to the whole issue of what is right and wrong, is there any standard of morality, of ethics, that all mankind ought to be held to? The best that science can say is, no, there isn't. That when you come right down to it, right and wrong is just a matter of what contributes to survival. What is often called in common vernacular, the law of the jungle. It's right if it keeps me alive, even if it doesn't keep you alive. Now, if it can keep both of us alive, that might be better, but that's very subjective. We can't even decide if that itself is right or wrong. Science hasn't given us the answers. The proposition that God is the creator and designer and sustainer and source of what is right and wrong is a far more intellectually satisfying answer for me and for many others than what's been provided so far. But in addition to science being one of the reasons that atheism has grown in popularity over the last century or so, is also just plain old human carnality or sin. There's always been people who, even when they didn't deny the existence of God, wanted to live as if He didn't exist. As long as God would just go off and mind His own business, whatever that is, and let them mind theirs, let them do what they wanted to do, and God don't interfere with me, that also has contributed to atheism. One of the most prominent atheists of 100 years ago, named Aldous Huxley, said in one of his books, "I don't believe in God." And he says, "One reason I don't believe in God is because I don't want to believe in God. Because if I believed in God, then I would have to believe there is a standard of right and wrong He holds me accountable to, and I don't want to be held to that standard. Therefore, I choose not to believe in Him. Well, that's my rough paraphrase, but that is an accurate presentation of what he said. And so many don't want to be held to a standard. But then last week, we moved from these more philosophical things, which provide great, excellent evidence, I believe, for the existence of God, to something that is very different. One of the challenges that atheism in recent years has thrown out to those who believe in God, if there's a God, why can't we see Him? Why can't we know He's there? Why do we have to use abstract arguments to come up with the fact that He's there? Why don't we have some concrete proof? We saw last week that there is a book in existence that claims not only that God exists in the abstract sense, but that God has spoken to us. Now that provides some concrete evidence, if true, that God has actually spoken. And that men have heard Him, and that those words, those things that God has said, have been written down, preserved, and passed on from generation to generation from then until now. That book is the Bible. But if the Bible is a book which contains words from God, that book claims that God is not asking us to accept that on blind faith. That is, just believe it just because it says it. But that God has said, here's how I'm going to document this. Here's how I'm going to authenticate this. Here's how I'm going to guarantee to you this is from me and not just from some other man. He says, these men I'm speaking through, they were often called prophets. I'm going to tell them things that are still going to come. And they're going to write them down. And these prophecies are going to exist for hundreds of years before the fulfillment of these things. Now, if these things don't come to pass, then you know these men aren't from God. And so God hasn't spoken. But if they happen, show me someone else who can do that. It's sort of God's challenge. He says, let me show you what I can do. Now, you put forth anyone else who can do that. God chose something that would be historically preservable. He didn't just audibly speak, He had it written down. And He had it written down hundreds of years before the events actually transpired. And they were written down in books that copies of them, we have them in existence hundreds of years before the events happened. And God says, that's how I'm authenticating. Prophecy is a powerful argument, not only for the existence of God, but for the fact that the Bible is from God. That it could, hundreds of years ahead of time, predict, just take some small subset, or big subset, I guess, of all the prophecies in the Bible, that there is a person going to come who's going to be from the family of David, the great king of the Old Testament, a direct descendant of him, who's going to be born in the days of the fourth world kingdom, according to Daniel, who will be born in a small town named Bethlehem, one of the smallest towns that was even known in biblical times, who would be born in a miraculous way because he would be born without a father. He'd be born of a virgin who would grow up to become a healer of blind people and deaf people and lame people, who would set people free who were enchained in some ways in their lives and couldn't be otherwise set free, who would start proclaiming good news of what God was doing for people, but who would be taken by His own people and killed, but would rise from the dead. Now, all that was predicted hundreds of years ahead. And we have the benefit now at this late, great date, over 2,000 years after those events actually happened, to have copies of the books that are old enough to have existed and do exist from a time before those events actually happened. So there's no way they could write them in after the fact. And these prophecies are clear and specific and testable and provable or not. And of all the books that exist in the world, and even all the books that exist in religions all around the world, the Bible is the only one that has it. And God says, this is my proof that this is from me. And so last week we talked about the fact that God, this God who exists, has actually spoken. Here's the proof. But today we're going to talk about something even more amazing. Maybe some of you have watched one or two of the movies I'm going to mention here just in passing. There's a very controversial, and for most people, including me, a movie I mostly didn't even understand when it came out. It was called 2001, A Space Odyssey. I'm not going to try to tell you what that movie was about because I'm not sure I know. But one thing that really stood out about it is at least two times in the movie that I can remember, and a third time in the follow-up movie that was made, 2010, A Space Odyssey, there was a monolith. Do you remember the monolith, those who watched that movie? It was this just big, looked like a piece of steel or stone or something, just smooth-sided thing that stood there. It first appeared to the apes. Then it appeared again just before man launched into space. And in the movie, what the monolith represented was there's somebody out there who has come down here. They didn't explain any of the details about that, but that's basically what the monolith represented. It meant there was somebody out there that we didn't know, that we had never seen, who has come down to Earth and has changed things here. That's what the monolith represented. You see, man is fascinated by the idea that there might be some kind of life out there, out beyond our beautiful Earth, hanging like a jewel in the midst of the blackness of space. Just tonight, the scientific world is all a twitter, both figuratively and literally, over the fact that a $2.5 billion space vessel is supposed to land on Mars. It will be the 40th, I believe, vessel we've sent to Mars. I don't know how much money that represents altogether. Just this one is, they're estimating $2.5 billion. And what is it being sent there for? To see if there's any possibility that there is or could be or ever has been any kind of life at all on another planet. They're not looking for two-legged creatures walking around like we do. If they can just find bacteria, if they can find a single-cell organism, if they can find anything, we will spend tremendous amounts of money and tremendous amounts of effort to find out if there's any possibility that life might be out there, and totally ignore the fact that the greatest life in all existence has already come down here. When Jesus came into the world, He was the object of those prophecies we were talking about. He's the one that it said He would be a direct descendant of the kingdom of the family of David, would be born in Bethlehem, born of a virgin, grew up to be a person who would make blind people see and deaf people hear, and set people free from those things that bound them in chains, and preach the good news about what God was doing. But it goes further than that. It tells us that He was, in a way we can't even fully grasp, God among us. God with us. It tells us in Matthew that an angel appeared to the man who was engaged to be married to Mary, the one who was going to be the mother of Jesus, the one through whom this child would be born, the virgin. And this angel tells Joseph that he should not be afraid to take her to be his wife, even though the child she was already expecting was not his, for they had not yet come together. And he was thinking, like any, I guess, normal person was, that she had already been unfaithful and they're not even married yet. The angel says, no, this child that she's bearing is the Son of God, and you will call him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. The prophecy by Micah that was read at the beginning of our service this morning, a prophecy that was made by this prophet who lived roughly in 720 B.C. If now, by going by modern ways of calculating, if Jesus was born around 4 B.C., which seems to be actually more accurate than 0 B.C. and 0 A.D., around 4 B.C., that would be 716 years before it happened. The prophecy was there, but you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be the ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from eternity. It says the one that would be born in Bethlehem is actually someone who is eternal. as near as we understand how life works, normally when a child is conceived inside of a woman, at that moment, or at some moment close to, when the male sperm and the female egg or ovum come together, that's when that life begins. But for this child, his life already stretched all the way back into eternity, and he was coming. This, shall we call it, outrageous claim, which if true, would provide the greatest proof of the existence of God. What's the evidence that would support such a claim? What's the proof that actually God would come to earth and live among us in the person of someone we know as Jesus? How would we possibly verify this? Surely, if he really was not just from God, but actually, in a sense, God on earth, he would have provided some kind of evidence, some kind of proof that would be verifiable and testable and convincing enough, even now, 2,000 years later, that would cause us to believe it. I've tried to think about this a little bit from the standpoint of someone who would be open-minded, I hope, but a non-believer so far in this fact. And I don't mean unbeliever. I sort of classify those slightly differently, even though I don't always clearly say it. A non-believer is someone who just doesn't believe one way or the other about something. An unbeliever is someone who's already examined everything and made their decision and says, I don't believe it. And so we're talking about how would a non-believer approach this subject? I would think that in order to know whether or not Jesus really was God walking the earth, there would need to be some established historical evidence for that. Some reliable historical evidence that still exists today for that. And there would need to be some kind of reliable documentation from those who were actually eyewitnesses and are expert witnesses to what supposedly happened. Now, an eyewitness is someone who actually was there and present and saw it and is speaking on the basis of that fact. An expert witness is someone who, whether they were actually there to see it themselves or not, can speak because they had available to them all the evidence and have examined it and weighed it and put it together for us. You know, in trials, even today, they have both eyewitnesses and expert witnesses whenever possible. The expert witness might not have seen the specific thing that the trial is about, but they have all sorts of expertise in considering evidence concerning things like that. While the eyewitness is the one that says, I'm sorry, I was there, I saw it, this is what happened. And so the non-believer, any of us in fact, should want to have some kind of verifiable, reliable documentation that this is actually true. And we might even want to consider what those who lived at the time, who didn't end up believing that this was true, themselves said about the subject. And so we start the first of this by saying that the claim of the documents that make up the New Testament part of our Bible, yes, that same book we were talking about last week that has the prophecies in it, the same book and the part of it called the New Testament, about the last one-fourth of it, claims that these are documents by eyewitnesses and expert witnesses to the fact that Jesus was in fact of God, from God, was God. That's their claim. They claim not only that this is true, that they saw it or they weighed the evidence and came to that conclusion, but here's what he did. Here's what he said. Here's what others thought about him. Now, some people will say, I don't care if you had books stacked from the floor to the ceiling claiming to be from eyewitnesses to this event. That's just too fantastic to believe. Well, we can't do anything about those folks. They're the same kind of folks that believe we haven't landed on the moon yet, who are convinced that the world isn't round but flat, and you can still sail off the end of it. You know, there are just some people that no matter how much evidence you stack up in favor of some, they're not going to believe it because they've already got their mind made up otherwise. But for those who are willing to consider evidence, God has provided sufficient, persuasive evidence to prove that Jesus was in fact from him. And I say that because the same people who would say that no matter how the stack of books is, from floor to ceiling, I won't believe it, they're the same people who are willing to believe on fairly slim evidence all sorts of other things from history And that's what we're talking about, something that happened in history. It didn't happen in 1964 when at least some of us were alive. This is something that happened in 4 BC through about 30 AD, long before any of us were here, and so it's history. How do we know that things in history happen? That Columbus sailed to America, that Vasco da Gama's, Magellan and his crew sailed around the world, although Magellan himself died before they got all the way around. How do we know the men went to the moon? How do we know anything in history? It depends on the documentation, the eyewitnesses, and what's been passed on to us. That's how. And people don't call into question the fact that Julius Caesar existed, that Abraham Lincoln existed, that Christopher Columbus existed, or that they did the things that are attributed to them because of the history, because of the documentation, because of the eyewitnesses. The same is true of Jesus. In fact, as compared to any other, I would say, any other figure of ancient history, the documentation of Jesus not only existing but doing and saying the things he did is 10 times greater than for any other historical figure in ancient history. And yet none of them are called in question. What does the Bible claim concerning him? First of all, we can hear from a few of the eyewitnesses. John is one such eyewitness in the fourth of the Gospels we have. John tries at the beginning of his book to write sort of a overarching statement about what he's concluded about this person, Jesus, that he had met and followed for 3 years and that then had spent the rest of his life teaching other people about him. So he says at the very beginning of his book in John 1 and verse 1, In the beginning, he means the beginning of all time. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. In Him was life, and that life was the light of men. Verse 10, He was in the world. Who? The light, the Word, the person he's talking about. And though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. Verse 14, the Word became flesh and lived for a while among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. And while that's sort of philosophical, what he's saying here, it's ethereal almost in one way. He then settles down to the actual facts of the matter. The rest of the Gospel of John is about this man named Jesus who comes and what he taught and what he said and what he did and what happened to him and about his resurrection from the dead and his return to heaven. And at the end of the book, John says in John chapter 20, in verse 30, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So here's a man who was an eyewitness. He says, I saw him, I was with him, here's my record of what happened. Here's my conclusion about the matter. The same could be said about Matthew and Mark, others who were eyewitnesses to these things. And then the other gospel, Luke never claimed that he saw Jesus himself. He came along just a little bit too late. But Luke, shall we say, hung out with all sorts of fellows who did know Jesus, who had seen him in person. And so when Luke writes his account, he starts his book by dedicating it to probably a government official who was also a believer in Jesus. And he says it this way in Luke 1 and 1. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the Word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Luke makes the claim at the very beginning that while he was not an eyewitness, he became an expert witness, and that his gospel is the evidence he had gathered to prove that Jesus really was who they all believed he was. We'll continue this study next week, but we need to realize that we have the documentation, historically reliable, defensible, to support the idea that one person walked this earth who is really from God. That's the claim of the book. And it provides for us not just the claim, but it provides for us what was the evidence that he himself provided to prove he was from God. And if these documents are historically reliable and they have been proven to be over and over again, then we cannot ignore what they're saying. Just one little story we close with from the life of Jesus. There was a time when he was in a home in the town of Capernaum. And the crowds were so large that they couldn't all even fit inside the house. People were outside looking in the windows, looking in the doors, everybody wanting to hear and see this teacher and this person who other people were saying did miracles. And some men had a friend who was paralyzed and couldn't walk. And they wanted to believe that Jesus could heal people like this, because they believed he was from God. And when they couldn't get in the door and they couldn't get through the crowds to get to Jesus as he was busy teaching all these people, they climbed up on top of the roof of this house, a flat top roof, and tore a hole in the roof right over where Jesus was. Now, at some point, no matter how good a public speaker you are, you just have to give way to what's going on. You know, I think long before the hole got big enough to do what they were going to do next, Jesus could no longer hold his audience. Even if he could keep talking, they're not going to be paying him any attention. But these men tear that hole in the roof and they let their friend down by ropes right down in front of Jesus. And Jesus looks at the man and he knows what they've done this for, what the reason is. And he looks at this man and he says, "Son, friend, I forgive you of your sin." We're never told the full story of this man's background, what was in his background that would not only be that he was not only physically disabled as he was, but that no doubt was a great spiritual burden on him. That to be so conscious of his guilt before God that Jesus would say, "I forgive you of your sins." And the great religious teachers of that day who were sitting on the front row listening to Jesus as he is teaching suddenly start leaning over and whispering to each other, "Who does this fellow think he is? Only God can forgive people of their sins." And Jesus says, "Let me ask you a question. Which would it be harder for me to do? Forgive this man of his sins or make him stand up and walk?" Now, I can answer that for myself. I might tell somebody I forgave them of their sins, and that's something invisible, and so at best you could have to take me at my word. But if I said I can make this man walk, everybody knows that's foolishness. And so you could probably conclude I can't forgive him of his sins either. So Jesus says, which is going to be harder for me to do? Forgive him of his sins or make him walk? He said, "But so you know that I have the power to forgive sins. Son, stand up and walk." And he stood up. And he picked up the pallet, the stretcher, that they'd let him down through the ceiling in and brought him there in and walked out. Who has the power to forgive sins? Only God. Who has the power to make lame people walk? Only God. Who made the lame man walk? God. Who was Jesus? He was asking people to draw a conclusion from, and so should we. We'll continue this study next week. We have an invitation song that invites us to think about these things and realize that when we come to the documentation that this Bible is, a historical record of what actually happened, we encounter this person who is like no other who ever walked the face of the earth. God walked among us. And if you don't believe in God, you need to come up with some other satisfactory, reasonable explanation of who Jesus was and how he was able to do what he did. Or else, you ought to accept his own explanation when he said, "I am he."